Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with David Brin. David Brin's an astrophysicist. He's the author of Earth, The Postman, Glory Season, and the Uplift series, a series of science fiction novels, and also the author of a very provocative novel about the future of internet and privacy called The Transparent Society. Welcome, David.
Good to be here.
Now, I've read recently an essay by you arguing that you felt that the inheritance tax was very important and you were very disturbed by Republican proposals to diminish or get rid of the inheritance tax, and arguing that people should vote for Gore on that ground. So you must have pretty strong feelings about the outcome of this election.
Well, naturally, one can get heavily involved in a number of issues. It's always important to step back and study history. Most science fiction authors are not scientists like me. Actually, most of them study history. In fact, science fiction should be renamed Projecting History, because when you're talking about the future, you're thinking about how the process of change might continue to affect people. And that's one reason why I feel strongly about the inheritance tax. And oddly enough, though, in a context of feeling that things are actually going pretty well in this culture. We're the world's first diamond-shaped culture, the first in which there are fewer rich than normal people, but quite a bit fewer poor people than people in the middle as well. To put that in perspective, almost every human civilization before ours was shaped like a pyramid, with a few at the top lording it over those below and preventing them from getting education, preventing them from rising up to compete with them. It was called feudalism. And the golden age of Athenian democracy was an expansion of the ruling class from just 1% to 7% very briefly and then back down to 1%. I think that Americans would be well off to notice how far we've come, what an incredible miracle this diamond-shaped social structure is. While we agonize over how to help the poor, and the conservative approach is to, you know, give them a hand instead of a handout, and the liberal approach is to make sure that all children have the protein and the wherewithal to get to compete properly, we can all argue over that, even getting vehement. But it's important to stop every now and then and notice the miracle that we're living, that the well-off outnumber the poor. That's never happened before. And to defend that, to defend the fact that we're a civilization in which bright children of the poor can go to university and become rich, we have to pay attention to what's going on. Most of the millionaires in America earned their millions. Most millionaires in Europe, with the tax laws they have there, inherited their wealth. They grow up expecting to be in the upper class, and all of the laws are twisted to make it so that they'll stay in the upper class. So you can see where I'm going here. I'm not against the I'm not in favor of the inheritance tax because I'm some social leveler, do-gooder who wants to take everything away from the rich and give to the poor. As a matter of fact, I consider myself to be a libertarian. I'm defending a world in which open competition is possible. This diamond-shaped social structure will be destroyed if we go over to a system where people can get rich simply by inheriting vast wealth. I think people ought to earn it every generation. Now, that doesn't mean that the inheritance tax shouldn't be reformed. President Clinton was all in favor of that. Set whatever minimum level you want to preserve family farms and small businesses, raise the exemption from 600,000 to 1 million, raise it to 2 million. I don't care if you raise it to 10 million. Above that level, a kid who did not earn the wealth should really earn his own wealth. That's my crackpot opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting you say that you're a libertarian because your novel, The Postman, many folks have studied this as a political document, and it's rife with political messages, which I'm sure were intentional. But the one that I was most struck by was that it was a real pay-on to the intentionality of citizenship and this imaginary community of nationhood. You weren't trying to defend democracy per se or egalitarianism per se, but the notion that we are all a part of a society and we have a commitment to this larger common good of the society. And that's that's something that's often lost by libertarians.
Well, it's an unusual position for a libertarian to take. And it's partly because, again, as an author of speculative history, I've read a lot of history, and I know how much worse everybody's had it except for us. A lot of my libertarian friends never stop to notice that this is the one civilization that developed libertarians.
Right.
So while they're so angry all the time, so self-righteous and screaming that all the rest of the citizens are sheep because they don't notice the horrible stuff that's going on, and because they voted in the last 20 elections for a partial welfare state, they must automatically be fools. No. If you just turn your time sense of history around and realize that we have been progressing toward a world in the future in which all children will be educated enough and healthy enough to compete openly with as little coercion as possible from state or anybody else. That's the libertarian goal. That's what defines whether or not you're libertarian. Now, libertarianism today turns off millions of voters because there's what's called lapel grabbing. You know, goggle-eyed grabbing of citizens' lapels and saying, "You fools." Well, excuse me, the American citizens are not fools. They've created the best civilization the world's ever seen, and yes, there are too many bureaucrats. And you know what? It's a transitional, awkward phase. We'll get there. But you got to start with some gratitude for what we've already got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have more freedom and more wealth than anybody ever had. I say thank you, civilization. Now, how can we improve it?
In your book, The Postman, the hero is, in fact, someone who recreates the postal service. And just that one idea, standing in for the rest of federal services, you know, all the how impoverished our life would be if there was no such thing as a postal service.
Well, you don't notice the water till the well runs dry. And a lot of the people who yammer against what we've got would be the first to cry, mm-hmm. weep bitter tears if we didn't have it. That's not to mean it can't be improved. And that's the one aspect that Kevin Costner got right when he, you know, took my novel and rather...
I wasn't even going to go there, but...
Well, he took a lot of liberties with it, but and we won't go there. But I will say this, that the basic moral elements of the story, the nostalgia for something lost, the sense of working together to rebuild it, this was written as an answer to all the Mad Max little boy, "Oh, I'd be a king if everything fell apart."
Mm-hmm. You had those folks in the novel, but they were the enemy.
Yes, I wanted to answer all that. We would feel sad if this went away.
You also had a technocratic civilization, one dominated by an alleged AI, and I saw a pretty explicit critique of techno. Utopian visions, the notion that technology is going to rule the world.
Oh, well, this is another group of very, very bright young men who are perhaps a little too bright for their britches, the techno-transcendentalists. And you're raising a lot of topics that each one would take an hour. For ages, people have felt that we could transcend above this mortal coil, this realm of reality of you know, where our bodies eventually decay and all that sort of thing. For millennia, people thought that this could be done by merit, by being a good person, or by appeasing the gods or God or that sort of thing. But the techno-transcendentalists are taking a new tack on the old dream. They believe that with the development of artificial intelligence, nanorobot technology that can go into your body and repair every piece of damage, neural links between the brain and the computers to get instant internet access to all information the moment you think of a question, they think that within about 30 or 40 years this will turn us, in effect, into gods. Well, it's an interesting idea. it's fascinating, and it's certainly a lot more optimistic than the futures that Hollywood depicts, say, in The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
where the computers are simple-minded.
Turns into food or batteries.
Simple-minded enemies. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly worth some interesting novels and stories. And it's a shame that a lot of the people who think that science fiction is just what you see in movies, movies have to be simple-minded in their approach to the future because you have to throw your hero into jeopardy for 90 minutes and keep him there. Therefore, no social institutions are allowed to work. If you dial 911 and skilled professionals rush to your aid, then where's the drama in the story?
Mm-hmm.
So in all our movies, I mean, people aren't pointing this out, in all movies, if you dial 911 and the police come and act skilled and they arrive quickly, then they're in cahoots with the bad guy. But if they arrive late and fumble around, that means they're honest and will be able to give you some backup, you know, about, you know, 80 minutes into the film.
Well, let me stop you there because you raised a lot of attention last year. Well, you raise a lot of attention every year, but last year in an article on Salon.com, two articles, you critiqued Star Wars and kind of raised the flag of literary science fiction versus movie science fiction and all the political manifestations of movie science fiction. And you critiqued movie science fiction and Star Wars in particular for having encouraged and reflected anti-democratic trends the hero worship, good elites, the born right to rule, and a number of other critiques. Was that a part of a literary versus film distinction that you were pursuing?
Not entirely. There are good movies, and there are good simple-minded movies. When I go to the movies, I go with several dials, like I have, you know, your receiver or your amplifier in your stereo system. And usually I have to turn down my mental age way down because there's just only so much you can fit in a film. And then you have to prepare yourself for the incessant propaganda messages. One is that nothing works in civilization because that's how you keep your hero in jeopardy for 90 minutes. Another one is the most relentless message that any people have ever been subjected to in all of human history, and that's suspicion of authority. Your listeners can probably not name a movie they've enjoyed in the last 20 years in which the principal character didn't stick it to some authority symbol several times throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
The implications of this propaganda campaign are ironic and immense, and we don't have time to get into them right now, but people should think about them. A lot of this is on my website,
right,
which is at davidbryn.com. But to answer your question, there are movies that I don't dial my mental age down for, like Gattaca. That was a movie for grown-ups.
Right.
But dialing your mental age down doesn't mean you have to dial down your taste or your sense of civilization. An example where my mental age got pegged down at 5 years old, but I enjoyed immensely and was a film very much in favor of civilization, was The Fifth Element.
Mm-hmm.
A totally crazed, totally senseless,
really over the top,
absolutely silly film,
mm-hmm,
that filled you with joy.
Mm-hmm.
Star Trek is adolescent. Its science is barely acceptable, but it's pro-civilization. People,
mm-hmm,
cooperate with each other,
mm-hmm,
to get the job done. Star Wars is anti-civilization. Everything is the Homeric, Ubermensch, demigod, hero. You must, the average person must choose which mutant to die for, whether it's the mutant with the common touch, which is Luke Skywalker, or the mutant who wears a Nazi helmet,
mm-hmm,
and blows up planets. But nevertheless, we are in a later film told we must adore as a little boy, because he was so cute,
mm-hmm,
and because he's filled with all sorts of mutant genes.
Little boyness overrides mass genocide.
I know. The whole thing is very bizarre, and I went into all of this in my article. And, of course, the article burned my bridges with about one-third of Hollywood. But here's the point. I was able to attack a billionaire, George Lucas, where it hurts most, in public, raise a lot of ire, and he can't do anything to me.
And that's because of the society we're in.
That's the difference between a pyramidal society And a diamond-shaped society, the only thing he can do is spoil some movie deals for me. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at least my children are safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to spend too much time talking about other people's work, but just on that theme, the contrast that you draw between Star Wars and Star Trek, other people have critiqued Star Trek for, although it has this liberal, optimistic, and multicultural view of the universe, there's very little discussion of politics within humanity. And for that reason, I liked Babylon 5, because you had a fascist takeover of Earth, and then these humans in exile forming a multicultural coalition to take back Earth.
I thought the politics in Babylon 5 were wonderful, because it showed a basically decent human civilization under dire threat, needing to be defended and saved.
Mm-hmm.
So it did not assume that we're members of a dismal, stupid civilization with stupid citizens. It said bad things sometimes happen,
mm-hmm.
and bad things do sometimes happen. That's why the most powerful form of science fiction is not the prophecy that comes true. Like people say, you know, I predicted the Internet in my novel Earth. Talked about global warming. Big deal. You know, I predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall, but I also predicted we'd have colonies on Mars. You know, prediction is... It is overrated. What's the most powerful form of science fiction is the self-preventing prophecy, a prophecy that so disturbs people mm-hmm. that they arm themselves, they gird themselves to prevent it from ever happening. This is what Rachel Carson's Silent Spring did, and the movie Soylent Green helped turn millions of us into environmentalists, and we live in a better world because of it. Dr. Strangelove, On the Beach, and Failsafe, warned of dangers of accidental nuclear war.
1984.
And 1984 is the granddaddy of them all.
Mm-hmm.
1984 armed us all with metaphors, symbols. Whenever you hate somebody in the other political party and you think they're grabbing for too much power, you accuse them of trying to be Big Brother.
Right.
And whereas it's grist for incredible, overwrought self-righteousness a lot of the time, nevertheless, it's very clear that this was part of the suspicion of authority propaganda system that has kept us free.
I'm speaking with David Brin. He's the author of many provocative science fiction novels and of The Transparent Society, which argues exactly some of the points that we're raising now. In The Transparent Society, you ventured into a discussion of privacy issues on the Internet, and you took a very surprising stance that very few on the left and the right have ever even given any credence to, and argued it persuasively enough that a lot of people have written about it, which is that too much privacy and too much security of our personal information could create a very unpleasant and unstable and unsafe world that would threaten the freedom for all of us.
Well, yes, you expressed it pretty well. Some people have said I'm against privacy and I want mm-hmm. us all to walk around naked, and that's absolutely not true. I treasure privacy. We would not be human without privacy. We have more privacy than any people ever had before in the days of overlords and pyramidal societies and hierarchical social structures. And we're used to it and we like it. We're going to have to redefine what the word privacy means. There will come a time in the future when what salad dressing you buy will be as public as what color sweater you wear in public, and you won't think about it otherwise, but you'll want your bedroom defended. You'll want to be able to say private things to the intimate people you share intimacies with. What I'm trying to say is that privacy and freedom are best defended in a civilization in which most of the people know most of what's going on most of the time, because that's what we've got. That's what has got us where we are.
Interesting contrast between the Florida political process and the Supreme Court, where every single action had to be done in public under a camera scrutiny in Florida, and we weren't even allowed to view what happened in the Supreme Court.
Well, what we're going to do now is, despite the fact that Jeb Bush worked very hard to use the system as it was, and he knew exactly what was going on, nevertheless, because the system is open, he is forced, for his own political survival, to totally dismantle and reform the system that he used so well. And that's what I mean by you can discover mistakes in a system of openness.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this means that others will discover your mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why people like secrecy is that given a choice between secrecy and accountability, people generally choose secrecy for themselves and their side, and accountability for those they don't like.
Now, is there also an element of the critique of mass society and the anonymity that permits like, what the Japanese call otaku, or the formation of these private psychopathologies or sociopathologies, that in a smaller town society where people know everyone else's business, those kinds of things are nipped in the bud and constrained by social interaction?
Oh, you're raising a wonderful, wonderful issue, because in effect, we are heading back to the village for technological reasons. When you're walking down the street 10 years from now, your sunglasses or your eyeglasses will have little cameras in the corner. They will scan everybody's face passing by, look up those faces in registries on the internet, and then supply captions with names underneath everybody passing by you, and look up their websites and give you a two-sentence summary of what these people say about themselves. And if you feel that way, a couple of sentences of rebuttal by their ex-wives. the pretty girls, you know, you might get their dating profiles.
The Japanese are already doing that.
They are, but here's the difference, you see. You could try to ban this technology and all the related technologies, but look at it this way. The cameras are expansions of human vision the way eyeglasses once were.
Mm-hmm.
The databases are expansion of human memory, the way books once were. You are not going to pass a law that is going to prevent human beings at the top from getting access to these new powers of vision and memory. It's just not going to work. Do you honestly think you're going to keep the elites from having such powers? If you're on the left, you fear elites of money and the old-fashioned aristocrats who oppressed us for thousands of years. If you're on the right, you fear the newer aristocracies of bureaucracy. Then there's the criminal elites. Then there's the new technological elite. None of these people will be prevented by your law. As Robert Heinlein once said, the only thing accomplished by privacy laws is to make the bugs smaller,
mm-hmm.
and to restrict them to some elite. So what you'll do, if you panic about these new powers, is you'll get the old village back, but it will be the old oppressive village that's described by Sinclair Lewis, by Babbitt, Potter's Town from It's a Wonderful Life, and mm-hmm. yes, you get people's behaviors better, but you also suppress eccentricity. But think, if we don't panic, if everybody has this, if most people know most of what's going on most of the time, and they can hold the mighty accountable the way we held Bill Clinton accountable last year and the year before that for staining that poor girl's dress.
That's transparency I could do without, Bill.
Well, you know, look, we had too much, but we all felt better knowing that we knew what he was up to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the American people judged it, saying, we're going to slap him on the wrist. We value him as a skilled administrator. Don't try to take away his services from us. Let's punish him in ways that won't deny us his services. And the Republicans did not listen. They didn't listen when that's what the American people wanted.
Let me switch topics for just a second. I recently interviewed Peter Singer, who's a bioethicist and philosopher, and I have a bioethics background myself. And one of the things I've been drawn to about your work in the Uplift series is the central ethical proposition that just as we have an obligation within our society to the weaker of our society to provide them with the nutritional supplements, education, whatever, technological aids to make them be full members of our society, we might have similar obligations to our closest animal relatives. Is that an ethical proposition that you take seriously, or is it just a vehicle in the novels?
Oh, I take it seriously for a basic reason. It turns out that there's something very, very important that we're finding out about human sanity, and one of the most important things, that word is coming back after being out for many, many years because it was used by previous psychological traditions to be oppressive. But now we're finding out some things that are culturally neutral that can be defined as hallmarks of sanity, and one of them is satiability. If you get what you said you wanted, it should actually make you happier and should reduce your desperate need for that thing. It's complicated. It goes beyond that. But here's the point. When you are satiated, you are able to feel more sympathy for others. If your children are starving, you'd kill other people to get food for them. But